Hi, everyone. I'm Stephanie Sachs, and welcome to Stirring the Pot. Here at Stirring the Pot, we bring together the best minds in food, nutrition, and health. Each week, we share a recipe, good food brands, great conversation, and lots of tips to make your life healthier. It's our goal to inform and inspire when it comes to my lifelong passion. As a kid, I was often sick, and doctors weren't giving me the answers I needed. So I learned to use food to help me get well and feel better. I went to culinary school, became a chef, then earned a master's degree in nutrition. Now I help people get healthy and stay healthy by understanding what they're eating and why. So reach out to me with any questions, and we'll stir the pot together. Stirring the Pot, where nutritious always meets delicious. Support for Stirring the Pot is provided in part by Naturopathic Healing Arts Center and Spa, East Hampton Dental Group, Hampton Jitney, and Saunders & Associates. Stirring the Pot. Today's show is Seed Time on the history, husbandry, politics, and promise of seeds. And I'll be speaking with Scott Chasky, working farmer, poet, and one of the fathers of our local community farming movement, and the author of this new book, Seed Time. But before we dive into that, here's Drive Through Nutrition. Beep, 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 yeah. In a fast-paced world of bad food choices, how can you make better ones? In other words, what can you tweak in your day-to-day to make a difference in your health? I want to talk about my blog from last week because my son asked me a very wise question after we saw a commercial over break for bacon bowls. They're these upside-down cupcake tins that are used to make these bowls of bacon using like roughly 6 pieces of bacon. And he said, "Mom, what are these people trying to do? Kill us?" And I thought that was very wise coming from an 8-year-old. And I looked at him and I said, "You know, Jack, I don't think that they have the intention of killing us per se, but making money is their primary concern. So for you as an 8-year-old, what's really important is to learn about the food that you're going to choose, to read labels and to ask questions, and never, well, very rarely, I should say, buy anything that shows up on the television." If you want to be on Drive Through Nutrition to address your questions or concerns, email me at info@stephaniesachs.com. Join the conversation on air. It can make a difference in your health. You're listening to Stirring the Pot with Stephanie Sachs on WPPB 88.3 FM, Peconic Public Broadcasting, Southampton, New York, serving the east end of Long Island and southern Connecticut. Now on to the good brand of the week. My buddy Geir Magnusson was in Iceland.
And it was so nice. I just came back from Iceland. I left the warmth and came to the cold. It's like an oxymoron.
You know? That's scary. So I didn't have him to taste my food last week, so I had my guest do that. And my good brand this week is Mary's Gone Crackers.
Mm.
Yeah, so I have them here. I'm going to give him a cracker, which looks like a pressed disc of grains. And, oh no, he's smelling it.
Yeah.
Let's see.
It's very thin. It's obviously very crackery-like.
Yeah. Ooh, I like that crunch. Let's hear it. Okay, and then I actually brought him some of my favorite cheddar cheese, which is this like a Kerrygold Irish cheddar, to taste with it.
It has a very distinctive taste.
It's very earthy.
It's very earthy. It's almost a little smoky, but it's not smoky. But it has a little sort of... I guess earthy is the right way to describe it.
Well, what I love about her crackers is she has, I think, roughly 7 or 8 ingredients in these crackers. She has different versions. She has herb, onion, plain. They really taste like you're eating the earth. You don't really find that often in any packaged goods, let alone crackers that are laced with sugar and hydrogenated oils and other junk. I do suggest that you spend a little extra money on Mary's Gone Crackers. Check them out at marysgonecrackers.com.
They're delicious.
Yum.
I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more. No, I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more.
And now it's time for our guest. Scott Chasky runs Quail Hill Farm in Amagansett, one of the oldest CSAs in the country. That's a community-supported agriculture. He is a working farmer, poet, and one of the fathers of our local community farming movement. He is the author of This Common Ground, Seasons on an Organic Farm, and his second book, Seed Time, on the history, husbandry, politics, and promise of seeds, is set for release next week. Chasky's passion for the land shines in all that he does on the hillside farm in Amagansett, but also in the many ways that he contributes to the local and global movement for more sustainable ways of nurturing nourishment. Scott, What a gift to have you stir the pot with me for a second time and have a chance to talk to you about this beautiful book that's awakening and inspiring people all over, for sure.
Well, thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
I want to open this up with a short excerpt from the prologue, which is, "Seeds are often given wings to assist their journey and to ensure another generation. It took several hundred million years or more to move from the birth of a single cell to the evolution of seed cones to the formation of seeds, and yet we now take for granted this magnificent dispersal, the language of transport of the planet kingdom, as if it were simply a mechanical inevitability rather than a mysterious gift of time." Scott, what inspired this book?
Well, thank you for reading that piece, because actually, you know, the book changes a lot as it goes along. And those words were actually in some of the first words I wrote.
And really?
Yeah. And, you know, I originally conceived of the book as quite different than it is now. And I sort of meant seeds as the actual things. But I also was trying to write about the seed kernel of the artistic process. And in my case, it's creating poetry.
Right.
As I got into it, there wasn't enough room for all of that, actually, because the topic of seeds in themselves is so vital right now.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
So vast, I really had to focus on writing a book. Well, a poet's book about seeds themselves.
So. Well, and that it is a poet's book about seeds. I mean, you hit so many different important topics in this book that is just so heartfelt and poetic. And like I said, when I started reading certain parts of it, it kind of brought me to tears.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
So in your beautiful poetic manner, can you describe the importance of seeds, the very beginnings of plant life, and the importance that they hold to generations to come?
Well, there's a wonderful statement by Vandana Shiva, who I quote a number of times, the Indian activist, scientist. She's a very powerful person and speaker. And she says, she uses the term seed freedom. And she says, without seed freedom, there is no food freedom. And so they are at the beginning. They're the very foundation. Seeds are the foundation of our entire food system. And so this, again, is something that led me to write about them. And besides the fact that I've been sowing seeds in the earth for 35 years, and I'm certainly never tired of the miracle. So I always recognize the miracle.
There's a great visual in your book that I got where you were talking about how you were sowing seeds, and you can do it by hand, kind of in a pouch, almost like a baby Bjorn.
Yeah, yeah, a satchel, yeah.
Yeah.
Across your chest.
Exactly. Yeah. So you think about like holding a baby and how precious that is, and then you can do it in a more mechanical way.
Mm-hmm.
And I just have this vision of you at Quail Hill with, you know, the sun shining down and just going along the field and
yeah, that's how you or any myself, any gardener, any farmer actually is most in touch with the magic reality of it, is to actually have the seed and put the seed into the earth.
And to touch it.
Yeah, it's actually, it's tactile.
Yeah. It's tactile. It truly is. So let's talk about seeds themselves. And how do you go about the process of choosing seeds and sort of the issue that we're up against with, you know, maintaining biodiversity in seeds and how do you approach that?
Well, you know, and this is another reason I decided to write this book, was that myself, like many other farmers in this era, are a little out of touch with the actual seed-saving process. But, of course, that's what human beings have been doing for 10,000 years or more. And it's only in the last century that farmers and gardeners have taken to ordering out of catalogs and not saving their own seeds. A lot of it really had to do with the beginning of bringing in hybrid seeds and starting in the 1920s or something like that. So I'm still the type of farmer that looks through catalogs, but we're like a lot of other people, and especially a lot of younger people, there's this great movement to actually relearn. And for the people who know, there's less and less of them, but there are people who know how to do it, to teach the whole art of seed saving. And it's not the most difficult thing in the world, but there's a lot to learn about it.
So it's collecting them from the plants.
Yeah, from the plants themselves. But, you know, you have to, it's the complicated part is the isolation, because you have to, if you want to be sure of what type of plant you're going to get, you have to isolate it from certain other species that may crossbreed, etc. So that part gets a little complicated. But the beauty of dealing with lots of seeds. So at our farm, for instance, we have over 500 varieties of seeds. That's all different things, from flowers to potatoes, and that's a huge amount to keep track of and to experiment with and everything. But it also keeps leading you back into the magic, which is the foundation of all of it, basically.
So, like, each year, do you go through the catalogs and choose what you're going to be planting and order the seeds?
Yes, we do. And what we're trying to do is learn as much as we can now about saving seeds. So we're saving some of them a little bit more every year, too. But most of it comes from catalogs, which are wonderful in themselves, basically.
Right.
And there's lots of great people who are, starting catalogs so that they can return to the open pollinated varieties, which are the ones that we've been losing, for decades now. And those are the catalogs that we're paying attention to.
I mean, these seeds hold a genetic code. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
What they bear and what they bring to us. And which brings me kind of to my next question. And that has to do primarily with biodiversity. Mm-hmm. And what has happened to biodiversity over the years, because it's a big issue.
It's a very big issue. It's probably the biggest issue, actually. There's a wonderful book that I would encourage everyone to look up if they're interested in this, called Shattering, and it was written in the late 80s, I believe, and by Kerry Fowler. And it highlights the work that I have a chapter about Vavilov, the great Russian plant explorer, and Vavilov in the early 20th century had located these centers of diversity, mm-hmm. as he called them, and those although it was a theory, it's still recognized as being largely true. It's changed slightly, but in those centers of diversity, and he'd located five or six of them in different places around the globe, these were special places on Earth where there was a tremendous amount of diversity, not only in species but of varieties within species as well.
Right.
What's happened is that those centers, of course, are diminished in quality because of human impact. And what we need to do is to preserve as much of that diversity as possible, especially in an era with climate change. That's what's so important. So what the opposite has happened in the 20th century is that we keep moving towards monocultures.
Right.
And, of course, then we get into the whole issue with global corporations peddling those monocultures, et cetera. And every time that's done in these areas where there was great diversity, the diversity suffers.
Well, and there's a terrible side to monocropping and these monocultures, is that, you can wipe out an entire crop in one fell swoop if something happens, where if there's any kind of diversity, you have some measure of success somewhere.
You have resilience.
Yes.
And that's the word. The
great
word is really resilience. So what we need to do... the thing is, we're at this time of where what we need to do is encourage as much diversity as possible. And in fact, the general inclination is that, we're moving in the other direction. So, we're trying to encourage as much as we can. That's another reason for bringing out a book like this, basically.
Right, because there are a lot of things that are being done, which I'm sure you can talk about, to preserve this biodiversity.
Yeah, it's mostly happening on a smaller scale, but on a smaller scale that is building momentum. And that's what I'm trying to encourage here.
Well, that is really wonderful, and I commend you for it. And we'll be right back to continue the conversation with Quail Hill Farm Scott Chasky, and author of the new book Seed Time on the History, Husbandry, Politics, and Promise of Seeds. I'm Stephanie Sachs, and with me is Scott Chasky, author of Seed Time on the History, Husbandry, Politics, and Promise of Seeds. And I was just telling him that before I came over to the station, I was sitting in a coffee shop, and I had his book sitting next to me, and one of my friends saw me there, and she looked over, and she said, "What are you reading?" She said, "I want to read what you're reading." I said, "It's a new book by Scott Chasky on seeds." And she said, "Oh, God, I've got to read that." I said, "Well, it's coming out next week, so go pick yourself a copy. Go pick up a copy." But Scott, I can't have a conversation about seeds without hitting genetic modification. And the idea that this is being widely used in agriculture and beyond. Salmon, for example. And as a farmer, do you see any need for genetic modification or genetic engineering?
I don't. As a farmer, I do not. And it was obvious that in this book, and it's one of the reasons that led me to writing this book, but I didn't want it to dominate. It is the longest chapter, and right. It's the hardest chapter to get through.
As it is the longest chapter in my book that's coming out in December. So
it's because we've got to do something about it. So.
We do. It's a problem.
It's a big problem.
For people out there who don't understand what genetically modified seeds are, could you explain that?
Yeah, it's not the easiest thing to explain. And another reason for writing this book is that so many members of our community farm would ask me questions like this, and I realized they just didn't know much about it at all. And whereas in Europe, for instance, it was front page headlines 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And only now, in fact, a week ago, I saw the first page one article written on GMOs on papaya in Hawaii.
100% of the crop, I believe.
Yeah,
99%
or something. Yeah,
99 point something percent of the papaya crop in Hawaii is genetically modified.
Well, so I mean the genetic engineering, GE, or is the production of genetically modified organisms to produce crops that are something brand new. So the GE movement for many years used a kind of skewed logic, saying that this was that we've been manipulating plants for a very long time, and it's true we have, but this is a very different thing. This is actually inserting a gene from a foreign species into the cells of another species. The example that I think people became aware of first were tomatoes, fish genes being added to tomatoes, to the Flavor Saver tomato, which was actually the first GMO crop to appear on the market.
In 1993, and it was by Calgene.
And it lasted about a year.
Exactly.
the tasteless
shrimp tomato or whatever it was. I mean, it's true. It didn't last very long, but... Yeah.
So we do have to emphasize that this is a very different, this is not traditional breeding. This is a very, very different thing. I have a quote in there from someone about, that you can mate one pig with another pig, but in genetic engineering, you try and mate a pig with a mouse or a potato.
Right.
It's very different.
a pig with a potato. I like that image. So if we really don't need GMOs, which you and I are on the same page here, why is the biotech industry and big ag pushing so hard for it and trying to really take over Mother Nature?
Well, it's the next technological fix. That is really it. And we, as a species, humans do seem geared towards that, right? And the Green Revolution, as it was called, was the last technological fix. And this is the next technological fix, and we seem to need to do that as a species. I don't need to do that, and you don't need to do that. But it's getting us into huge problems.
And
the bottom line, of course, is profit.
Yes.
That's what we're talking about.
Well, it brings me to another excerpt from your book here, where you say, in an age obsessed with industrial efficiency, it is prudent to acknowledge the danger along with the gifts that accompanies technological advance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're in an age oftentimes where we don't think of the consequences of these technological advances.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very scary.
Yeah, they are.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you start simply with the fact that once the genetic material in the form of pollen is out there, where's the protection for crops and people, farmers everywhere who are growing organically, or et cetera? There is no protection for that, because once the material is released into the environment, it's there.
Right. And there was also something that you had said, too, about the seed catalogs and how... a lot of these catalogs out there are trying to push monocropping to farmers and making them believe that it's the way to go and it's the way to protect your crop. And, someone like you responds to that with, no way. But there are farmers out there who have, who have sipped the Kool-Aid.
Yeah, on a very large scale. So, for instance, when I started farming in this country, you know, and was involved immediately in the community farming thing. There was no acreage in the country in 1990 devoted to GMO crops, and now there's almost 200 million acres
I know.
In this country. That's astonishing
it's
in that amount of time.
Astonishing. Yeah. And there's also acreage that we don't necessarily know about. There was the whole issue, mm-hmm. you know, of GMO wheat that was found
right.
in Oregon.
In Oregon, right. Mm-hmm.
You know, so
right.
what's happening is that these seeds are dispersing
right.
everywhere. And we don't really know what's going on.
Well, that's a great example because, in fact, GMO wheat was never approved.
Never
approved in
never
this country.
Approved.
So actually, that GMO material in the everyone was confused by it.
Right.
And, you know, what's it doing there? I mean, but it was found there, and it was actually came from trials.
Right, that were
wheat
being
trials
done.
That
yep.
were done years previous to that.
Yes.
And no one has any idea how that got there by the wind, basically.
Well, and also the point that you made before, which is so true, is that the farmers who are not using GMO seeds and wanting to maintain some level of integrity at their farms, sometimes they will end up growing these crops unknowingly, and a lot of times they get sued by these biotech industries.
Yeah, I mean, if anybody wants to look this up, there's so many instances now, but the case of Percy Schmeiser
right.
in Canada is the premier case of that, basically, and it took him many, many, many years to fight it in court. And in fact, the real tragedy is that he had bred his own canola for 50 years. He'd spent on breeding his own canola, and that was lost because of foreign material that he had nothing to do with that blew into his fields.
It's just, it's yeah. unbelievable. It's like just this mass level of destruction to our food system. And like I often say is this topic, the one of genetic modification, is really just the epitome of a food system gone awry.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I want to go back to your book because you offer in this book not only inspiration and information, but a lot of resources. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like a portal to a world for many people that they don't know a lot about, mm-hmm. and they can learn a lot more based on the resources that you provide.
Yeah, that's what I hope. I mean, and I came back to trying to answer some questions by farm members on our community farm, and I realized that people just know so little about this absolutely incredible topic, it's our food system.
I know.
That's what we're talking about. We're talking about our health.
I know, and it's, you know, I always say that people spend more time researching a car to buy
yes.
than they do about yeah. the food they're going to put in their own bodies yeah. or in their children's bodies.
Yeah.
So, Scott, where can people find you? Obviously, on Quail Hill Farm in the fields.
Yeah, they can look for me out in the fields. And sometimes they find me on a tractor in a backfield, as a matter of fact. But I am very accessible there. And, of course, I work for the Peconic Land Trust, a conservation organization.
Right.
Quail Hill Farm is part of the Peconic Land Trust. So there's a website, Peconic Land Trust, Quail Hill Farm. The book, you know, you can order on Amazon. It's been there for a while. I would love it if local people frequent Conio's for the book. I'm giving a reading there on February 15th, I
believe. Oh, that's great.
And then I'm giving another reading at the parish, although that's date hasn't been set sometime in
Where
February.
Where can people find out about that?
On the parish website. It's
okay.
It's not out. The date hasn't been chosen. But Conio's, I know, is February 15th. And I'll be doing some other readings, etc. And, you know, these days, Google
right.
Seed Time or my name, and you come up with a lot.
Oh, I urge everybody who's listening to buy a copy of this book, Seed Time. You can go to Amazon. I'm going to link to it on my website as well.
Thank you.
It's linked, actually, already. But I'll link it under resources. There are very few books that I read that I consider to be a true gift. And I had said to you during the break that Hope's Edge by Frances Moore LePay and Anna LePay is one of them. And I equate this to that book. So thank you for this beautiful gift, Scott.
Oh, thank you for saying that.
Yeah. Thank you. And thank you for being a part of the show. And congratulations on the book and all that you do. And I wish you the greatest of success.
Oh, thank you so much. Wonderful to be here.
Now it's time for the weekly Yum Coast to Coast with Sacks and Katz.
Life is just a bowl of cherries. Don't make it serious. Life's too mysterious. The sweet things in life to you were just loaned. So how can you lose what you've never owned? Life is just a bowl of cherries, so live and laugh at it all.
Hello, my California collaborator.
Hello, my New York collaborator.
So, are you working on a soup today? Because you love soups.
Oh, you know I am. I take advantage of every day during the winter months to make soup. I mean, I could live on soup.
You know, so could I.
Well, you know, my pot, my big magic mineral broth pot.
Right.
Stock pot, I could fit in there. It's that big. Like a studio-size apartment in New York City. So I don't know if that's big, actually. Maybe.
Well, you're little, so you could fit into the pot. So
I could fit into the pot.
So this I'm looking at here because, of course, you know, I know what recipes we're going to talk about before we get on the air and talk about them. So I'm looking at this gorgeous curry cauliflower soup from the Cancer Fighting Kitchen.
This is one of my favorite soups. Cauliflower is such a wonderful vegetable that's full of excellent cancer-fighting enzymes, and it is in sore need of a PR campaign. You know?
I think you give it a PR campaign in all of your books.
Well, I do, because I love it, and I love how herbs and spices adhere to it, and I love roasting it, and that's what I do in this soup. I roast the cauliflower. I have tossed it again with some curry powder and cumin and coriander and a little bit of cinnamon, and it's when it comes out of the oven, it's like eating candy.
Ooh.
And then I blend it in my Vitamix.
Vinny the Vitamix.
And with 6 cups of magic mineral broth, and, you know, I garnish it with this apricot pear chutney.
Ooh, so it's like a sweet and savory type of dish.
Yes, so it really tickles the taste buds, and it's incredibly immune-building. And this is the time of year where, you know, again, soups are such nutrient-dense foods.
Well, and they're so grounding, too.
Yes.
I love taking a big hunk of, like, gluten-free. My favorite gluten-free bread is this Canyon Bakehouse, and I love toasting it and then dousing it with olive oil and dipping it in soups. It's so good.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. So I'm assuming this freezes very well.
This freezes fantastic. I mean, this will keep in your freezer for 4 months.
Wow.
So I always recommend make a batch and freeze half in portion-sized containers.
That's a great idea.
And don't forget to label it.
Absolutely. And don't forget to check out the weekly Yum recipe this week. It's curry cauliflower soup, and you can find it on my blog at stephaniesacks.com. Scott Chesky is one of my warriors. I urge you to check out his beautiful book, Seed Time, on the history, husbandry, politics, and promise of seeds, to learn how you can renew your role as a citizen of nature. And I want to add that the cover of his book is a beautiful photograph taken by local healer and lover of all things botanical, Maria Bowling. I'd like to thank my guests, Scott Chesky, Rebecca Katz, and to everybody who helps me stir the pot, including Gear Magnuson. Happy to have you back, Gear. James Blue Weiss, Amy Griggs, Klieger, Lee Ritchie, and Nancy Atlas, who you can check out live at Bay Street Friday nights at 8 p.m. through January and February. Tickets are $15. And each week she plays alongside a notable musical guest. And I promise you, it's a true treat. To stay updated and informed and to keep this conversation going, sign up for my weekly blog at stephaniesacks.com. That's Stephanie with an F for food, messing with Mother Nature is this week's title. And somehow I go from hair to seeds. I have no idea how, but I do. You can catch the weekly Yum recipe on my blog as well. And for next week, Tea for Two with Alex and Tatiana of Southampton's Plain Tea. This show would not be possible without the generous support of Naturopathica Healing Arts Center and Spa and Saunders and Associates. And thank you for tuning in to WPPB 88.3 for Stirring the Pot, where nutritious always meets delicious.